first up, we're most pleased to have Elliot McVeigh here, who had been at Hopkins for a long time and did a lot of the early work on cardiac tagging and other things, and is now at the Laboratory of Cardiac Energetics in the NIH Intramural Program. So, Elliot, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for the invitation to come and talk. So, I'm going to talk about a sort of heterogeneous topic, about cardiac tagging, which is a way of, I'm sure you've seen it to this point in the conference, a way of measuring myocardial motion. And look at coupling that motion with electrical measurements in the heart. And I'd like to show you some of the data we have in moving towards doing this in real time in diseased hearts, those hearts which have an infarct, which is a problem in healthcare, trying to predict those patients that will have a fatal arrhythmia after they've had an infarct. So if you have a heart attack, you go to the hospital, you get treated, can walk away with a big chunk of your heart, which is dead. So it's a big chunk of fibrous tissue, basically. And the fundamental question there is that going to generate some kind of electrical abnormality, functional abnormality, that will either cause a fatal arrhythmia and you will die very suddenly, or will lead to heart failure and you'll die much more slowly. I'm sure I've forgotten some folks on this list, but the data you'll see is a compendium of data from many people from both Hopkins and the NIH, and I've tried to on each slide say whose data it is. If I've missed it, I'm sorry, but this is a group at the NIH. Many grad students were involved in this as well. I'm trying to point out whose data it's been. So this is Dan Ennis's data, and it's a high-resolution, three-dimensional MR tagging set. And this is a single slice out of probably 16 short axis slices through a small beagle heart. And the reason the tags look so good here, and the reason they stay essentially quite clear all the way into systole in large deformation is that the slice from which this data is obtained is quite thin. Okay? And the tags, what they are planes of saturation through the tissue. So they run perpendicular to the screen here, and they run all the way through the tissue. And so as the heart deforms, if that plane of saturation shears over, if you don't have a thin slice, the tag blurs out into a sort of a uniform gray background. This data, Dan came to me and said, I want to do high resolution tagging. I'm going to do it with 3D MR, and I said, that's ridiculous, it'll take too long to take the images. But he forged ahead and got it to work, and the way he and Rich Thompson and Andy Derbyshire did this is they did both respiratory gating and cardiac gating, and they did a long 3D acquisition. So you get many slices at high time resolution. I think this is about 9 or 10 milliseconds frame to frame. So from that, if you just do very simple analysis, you can see that you can get transmural resolution of mechanical events. And so within the wall, you can look at differences in what's going on in the mechanics. So this is at the onset of contraction. What is color-coded here is radial thickening. So yellow means the tissue is getting thicker or expanding in the direction radially towards the center. So you see there's like an onset here, and you can actually see the tag deforming where that early radial thickening is occurring there. So it comes up with a bright yellow color. And then 40 milliseconds later, about 10 or 4 time frames later, you can see a lot of radial thickening in just this local segment here and actually a compression down there at the endocardial layer. And so this is an example of spatial resolution of the mechanics that's available when you have tagging at this density. It turns out what's going on here is probably an excitation escape. These were paced, these dogs, and perhaps what's going on here is the pacing is escaping from the atria and coming down the septum early. It might be exciting the septum early. I doubt this is a natural phenomenon, but just as an example of the resolution available. This data is from a number of years ago, and this is looking at mechanics from tagging in dogs that were paced. And so you get multiple tag slices through the heart, and you do a 3D fit to the displacement field, and then you compute strains. And each acquisition probably takes about 20 heartbeats for each slice, something like that. But you're pacing the dog, so it's all synchronized to that pacing signal. And Fritz Prinzen put us on this pathway of doing this type of pacing experiment and looking at the sort of mechanical consequences of pacing from different loci in the heart. What's going on here? This is a left ventricle. The right ventricle would be right here. It's not rendered. The green dot is the middle of the septum. Okay. This, in a dog heart, the blue represents circumferential shortening. So if we draw a ring in this direction, it's shortening in that ring direction, so that the whole thing shortens down. If it gets shorter, it's blue. So this is atrial pacing. Everything is essentially very synchronous. The shortening is uniform around the heart. If you pace up here on the free wall, so now this is a bipolar electrode pair sewn onto the free wall of the heart, and you start the mechanical activation up there by pacing the heart externally. You have a voltage generator, and you pace it. What you can see is this is not an electrical activation map. This is the mechanics that is coincident from that activation. So you get a very nice resolution of the way the mechanics first pre-stretches the septum when you're pacing over here, and the shortening moves from that pacing location around. And if you move the pacing loci into the right ventricle onto this side, you get the same basic pattern, just a different origin. So, very nice. Now, what's it useful for? Well, this is a normal graduate student circumferential shortening map, okay, in a left ventricle. The one on the right-hand side is from a 65-year-old male who's in end-stage dilated cardiomyopathy. And so this is heart failure, and this is when your heart expands, the wall gets thinner, and often what happens at the same time is the heart becomes very dissynchronous, or it beats at different times in different places. So you can see here what's going on is early on you get a contraction over here, and then the contraction occurs here. So this heart is not only dilated and big, it's basically sloshing blood back and forth like this in an asynchronous manner. So with Dave Cass, and actually initially some people from Guidant, we looked at using this type of data to predict whether or not a patient would respond to resynchronization therapy. And that is, can you retime the pacing on this heart to cause a concentric contraction by externally pacing the ventricle with a pacemaker? So you have multiple leads, pace the heart in different places, and get it to contract uniformly. And it turns out you can, for any patient, they have a dissynchronous heart, you can make a sort of bullet plot like this, where this ring represents an apical slice, the outer ring represents a slice up at the base of the heart, and you know, the position around the heart is labeled here, so the septum around anterior. And just make a sort of activation map, mechanical activation map, where this is early activation and this is late activation. And this gives you a clue as to where you should pace, you know, where you should center your early pacing signal to compensate for this early activation. Turns out you can only get the pacing lead to certain places if you put it in vessels. If you slip it on the outside of the epicardium and inside the pericardium, you can pace virtually anywhere. That's still in development. Not just hearts. You can also tag other things. And this is a leg. This is the knee right here. And this is in a short scanner. I'll show you. There's tags placed down in this real-time acquisition, and so the scanner is just running continuously, putting out real-time data. The person in the scanner hears the pop of the tags or presses a button to make tags, and then does a flexion of their knee, and then you can see briefly that displacement field of the skeletal muscle. Makes cardiac muscle look pretty smooth, right? So we're in the process of trying to figure out how to do a set of experiments in different limbs to model this displacement field of different muscles. So the question is, well, how do you time all of this so that you can, you know, get your flexion right on the tagging? Well, with this scanner, it turns out that You can actually do the experiment, right, and run the scanner at the same time. So there's a coil here on my leg, right, and I've got it sitting like this, and it's in isocenter. This is a really short magnet, so the thigh is in isocenter. And then here you can see the real-time data coming out, so you can keep your leg in the right place and do it at the right pace. And you can press a button to hit the tags, right? So you hit the tag button and then you move your leg. But obviously, you know, for a graduate student, we have to put optical sensors and trigger things. Do it right, right? But for a first pass, it's pretty good. So let's get back to the heart. So we looked at the modeling you can do by taking tags and looking at the mechanics. How does one measure the electrical activation over the heart? Well, we have been working with some guys at University of Utah for a number of years now and visited their lab, I can't remember how many years ago now. And they've been very kind in sort of putting us, you know, sort of holding our hand through the paces of using a sock to make electrical depolarization maps of the heart. So these are silver wires, and basically the insulation is burnt off the end, or taken off, and then sewn into the toe of a woman's pantyhose, right? And it's done by one person in Utah. I'm not sure what happens when she decides to retire. But anyway, she puts this sock on a former that has marked places, and she very carefully makes these socks. So can you do a cardiac tagging experiment when this hunk of hardware is sitting over top of the heart? Remember, MRI, the heart now, in order to excite a signal from MRI, you have to transmit radio frequency energy into the tissue. That doesn't look to me like a good idea when you've got all of this, all these conductors sitting around the heart. And basically, it was six of one, half dozen of the other whether it would work, but it turns out, with that sock on the heart, you can get very decent MR images. Okay. And we haven't as yet obtained electrical measurements while we're scanning, okay? Because you're going to have some fairly significant voltages that you have to filter out on those wires. But you can do a MR experiment and then take electrical data right away, okay, in the magnet. And so here's the sock when it's sitting on a heart in the surgery. Okay, and these are, you know, pacing leads, etc., and there's markings on the sock, so we know where things are. Afterwards, the sock is hung, and the position of the electrodes is marked, and then you can look at the depolarization signal from each position on the heart. So this is what the sock looks like, sitting on the epicardium. These are pacing leads here. There's a set of pacing leads up here. This actually is a constellation catheter, it's called, which has 64 electrodes that are measuring endocardial electrical activation as well. And you cannot put this thing into the heart and measure and take MR images because it has non-MR compatible materials in it. But you can certainly do it under fluoro outside and then pull it out and push the dog in the scanner. And then after everything is all said and done, you can then take multiple views of this structure, sort of different angular views of the constellation catheter electrodes, markers, see these little spheres here? These are MR X-ray markers. We can see these on MR, those circles. We can also see them under X-ray. So you can register where this structure is with respect to the other things on the heart. Remember, for the electrodes on the surface, we can just tick those off with an arm. But Guy Schechter worked out a very nice way in software to figure out where these points are from two views, and you can reconstruct a map of both endocardial activation and epicardial activation in that part. So, afterwards, after you've done the experiment, you can go back, look at where, at your electrical signal, say from an electrode position at here, B, and plot out the depolarization signal for that loci and the related mechanical signal at that point and correlate those two signals. And so here's just an example of one pair. And so this would represent, you know, the electrode from the sock would, you know, there's displaced from each other by about a half a centimeter to a centimeter, something like that. So that's kind of characteristic of what's going on at that centimeter-ish scale. And the mechanics is probably about a, you know, half a centimeter scale as well. So it's a little chunk of tissue. And that represents the mechanics circumferential shortening. So here the tissue is stretching. It stops stretching here and starts to contract. And then this is end systole here, and then it starts to stretch again. So that's the mechanics. And what's inducing that is that depolarization locally induces that mechanical response. So you can, when you have the SOC signal here, which is this is just raw voltage signal, so you can sort of see the depolarization signal from a heart that's paced in the right atrium. This must be a left bundle by the look of it, because it's basically it's late activated on the left side, so this must be a left bundle heart. So we get early activation here, late activation over there. And then in that same heart, you have the mechanical response to that pacing in the atrium. Okay, so you have, this is a classic left bundle mechanical response. This is circumferential shortening early in the septum, and then it moves around to the free wall. And so the timing of how this mechanics tracks with that electrical activation can be worked out. And then you can do it for different pacing loci as well. And here's an example of how in a left bundled heart, okay, so this is a heart where they, you know, there's two branches of the Purkinje system in the heart that activate the left and the right sides of the left ventricle. If you block out the left side, you get late contraction on the left side. So here we have early contraction, late contraction. And when you do biventricular pacing, where you pace both sides of the heart with a tuned delay, you can resynchronize this heart to contract uniform. So that's, this is that application of cardiac resynchronization therapy. In the animal model, once you've got all of that data in the bag, and so you've got mechanical modeling, you've got electrical modeling, you may have the endocardial electrical signal under certain conditions, the epicardium. Unfortunately, you don't have an electrical signal on this surface of the right ventricle, you just have it on the outer surface. Excuse me. But you have fantastic, you know, anatomical detail of where things are, and you can, and this is data from Pat Helm, it's also here, you can measure the fiber angle using diffusion MR. That same heart. So the fiber angle is important for how the electrical signal propagates through the tissue, and also is also important for the mechanics, although all of that still has to be worked out in some detail. And so this is one of Pat's really nice images of the 3D heart and a map of fiber angle as a function of position, which I'm sure you've seen thus far. Gorgeous data. So all of that is in very well-controlled, oftentimes paced circumstances where you are controlling the heart rate because you provide the pacing signal. So you know exactly when things are going to happen. And taking MR data under those circumstances is ideal because we can take multiple data sets and synchronize them together quite simply because we have the clock. You know, so we can phase lock everything with our own. In nature, when someone has an infarct and they start having arrhythmias, all that synchronization goes out the window, right? Because each beat can be quite different depending on the delay between that beat and the last beat. The filling changes, so the mechanics changes. Also, the sequence of activation can change from beat to beat depending on how the sequence of electrical activation. So what we focused on in the last couple of years is to try and provide real-time acquisition at a rate that is commensurate with looking at arrhythmic hearts, hearts that are not beating synchronously at all. This is a hard problem. Where you can start, though, I mean, MR led the way to real-time by looking, by figuring out ways to reduce the amount of data required to make a movie frame. If you're making a movie, okay, so you have essentially some continuity in the time domain, it reduces the amount of data that's required for each one of those frames, because some things don't change, basically. And so you can reduce the data acquisition time for each frame if you're making a move. So what one thing is towards this is parallel MR. And we have a system, and these are available commercially now, where you have 32 independent MR channels. And so each one of these coils is an independent MR coil. So you could make an MR image from each one of those coils. And the question is, how do you put all those together to actually reduce your data acquisition? Well, it turns out if you know the B1 intensity field of each one of those small coils, you can use that information as one component of the spatial encoding of the data. Our primary way of spatial encoding data in MR is from the outside, we impose a phase shift on the signal as a function of space. And so you put one sine wave on over the object and you take a signal, then you put three sine waves, you take a signal. So you can basically, put these basis functions on it, and then through Fourier transform, figure out where everything is. Another way of imposing that signal difference is by these little coils in different spots. They have different intensities. But you need to know those intensities. You need to have a coil B1 map, or a sensitivity map, in order to do the inverse problem, to use those coils in your encoding. So we have come up with a way for mixing both temporal information to reduce data acquisition time and this coil information, which is a method. The coil information is a method called sense, which you can read about, no problem. This is called T-sense. It uses time domain information to help with the sense encoding. And so in the time domain, if I'm making a movie, okay, so each one of these frames from each coil is a movie, what I can do is for each alternate frame of the movie, I will jitter my sampling cone, okay, in time. So I have a sampling cone here, and then I jitter up one, then come back to this, and up and back, and up and back, and up and back. What that each individual frame is undersampled by a factor of two. So if I make an image just from the solid lines, I get something that looks like this, okay, and it has a foldover artifact. Basically, the stuff, at the top folds back over underneath to the bottom. It's aliasing. Classic aliasing. When I play the movie of those aliased images, okay, certain objects in the field of view flicker, obviously, right? Because when I shift my sampling cone, the phase of that ghost or of that alias ghost changes. And so when I play the movie, those things flicker. And those things that are stationary flicker at a very precise frequency, which is the frequency of this jitter. So I can filter those out quite accurately with a narrow band filter. Right? So I have something that's flickering at one frequency, I just filter that thing out and leave a big time bandwidth for other things that are moving in the field of view. So what we do is we take this data, do the FT, you get these flickering images. First thing we do is we decide on a temporal bandwidth filter and filter out to get smoothed images that don't have any artifact in them. And they also are temporally smoothed, actually, because this filter bandwidth is quite low. And what we do with these pictures is we calculate the relative intensities of the different coils, okay, using these pictures. Okay, you smooth them out and calculate that intensity. That goes back into computing the sense coefficients, which then allows you to reduce your ghosting artifact by a complementary mechanism in this flicker reduction. So that comes back, you do classic sense, and then if you still have some ghosts and stuff, you can crank out a very broadband filter to eliminate that one flicker ghost at the end. And so this is a nice way of doing parallel imaging, especially when you're doing real time where you're moving the scan plane, because your coil maps can change dynamically. So here's some results from T-Sense, just in a full-blown field of view looking at cardiac function. So with taking half the data We can obtain 15 frames a second here in a human chest. And then if we take a quarter of the data, we get up to 30 frames a second. And so the image quality, while the resolution is low, the dynamics are pretty good, pretty well preserved for looking at cardiac function. You can also use similar techniques to try and do tagging with single beats. Okay, so you tag and get all of your images basically as a real-time sequence after you've triggered the tag. And this movie shows a stationary diaphragm during a Valsalva maneuver, and then the patient starts breathing, and you see the change in the dynamics of that. So that's one application of real-time. Another application, instead of doing real-time, is you just acquire super high-time resolution pictures in a reasonable number of heartbeats. And so here you have 9 millisecond time resolution, but in 600s, okay, which is fairly easy. The other development that we're looking at is trying to extend this sense encoding into two orthogonal directions. So do it in the phase encoding direction, okay, to reduce the data acquisition that way. And also, if we're taking a 3D image, we do phase encoding in the Z direction or the y-axis direction, and we'll do partition encoding or we'll do sense reduction in that direction, because remember we have that whole array of coils. They're here, but they're sitting over top. And this actually works pretty well. If you do a rate 8, so this is 1/8 of the normal data acquisition, a rate 4 in the phase encoding direction and a rate 2 reduction in the through plane phase encoding direction. In a reasonable number of heartbeats, I don't know what this is, 32 channel rate, I can't remember how many heartbeats this is, but it's on the order of 16, you can get many planes, and inside each plane you have a movie. So you have a perfectly registered 3D beating heart. You don't have different breath holes and have this sort of misregistration of where the slices are. It's all obtained in one acquisition.
How thick are these?
They're probably about 6 centimeters.
With that no overlap, or do they?
Well, no, there isn't. There's just overlap in the sense of the point spread function of the FFT. That's what the overlap is. And you throw away slices at the end, because inside your volume you can just wrap around. And so you basically have discarded slices on each end of the volume. So here you have 16 slices. It was probably 20 were obtained or something like that. And now this is the dog riding a bicycle slide. The JPEG or MPEG encoding is pretty bad on here. But the images are pretty bad to start with. So it's... the same 16 slices, but the difference here is that this data is not taken during a breath hold, it's just taken in real time. Okay, so here we're doing a rate 12. So there's a rate 6 reduction here, which accounts for the loss in image quality, but obtaining about 6 volumes per second. So if you want the location of large structures, sort of during respiration, looking at simple volumes, perhaps you want to look at how you should navigate things, this type of acquisition is feasible, and that's real-time 3D imaging with this high-rate sense. Now, it would be better to bring this down and this up, obviously, to 4. So you'd reduce, do a rate 4 sense in this direction, rate 3 here, but the geometry of the coils is set up so that it may or may not be possible. High-resolution imaging of infarct is something that gives you the opportunity to basically understand the real details of the substrate for some kind of activation abnormality. So here's a heart. This is a dog heart. It has an infarct. Starts up here at the base, and we're moving down through the slices, and you see the tremendous detail you can get in the geometry of this infarct. So here is on the endocardium. You can see that there are little islands of normal epicardial tissue that are embedded into this infarct. So it has kind of a rough surface here, and you can see that little channel of normal tissue running through the infarct. So the, one of the open questions is, if you knew this geometrical or morphometric structure, could you make some kind of prediction that a activation wave over the ventricle could slow down through this channel and then loop back and re-excite itself? So the heart would re-excite itself. So I've got a slow activation blob here and the rest of the heart. I have an activation wave that comes through, and some activation is very slowly going through the blob and coming around the back, and then it reactivates that tissue that's at the backside that is now out of its refractory period and causes some kind of reentrant loop. This turns out to be a very difficult problem to pursue, but we spent some time in being able to get these high quality, high resolution, they're called late enhancement infarct images. And I won't go into the details of this, but suffice it to say that you can measure your images here with T1 weighting, and then while you're out here, you can do a quick low flip angle image to get coil correction, phase correction, and you can reconstruct actual images that have negative and positive values, which increases the quality of the image to something like this, so that the myocardium here is negative. The signal is actually negative. If you just did a standard image, late enhancement image, this would have popped up positive and reduced your contrast here. So we're happy with these images. What does the electrical data look like around tissue that will become an infarct? This is ischemic tissue right here in a dog heart. This is where the right ventricle basically inserts into the left ventricle here. And so you can see this big patch of data that has a low voltage to begin with, and then it has this late depolarization, if that is depolarization, in that ischemic zone. And here's the time clicking over. And this is 7 minutes after we've occluded a vessel upstream. Then you look at the type of SOC data you can get. This is at 18 minutes. Here's the time running here, and you can see that this is the seconds right here. So this is in slow motion, basically. But now we have a very interesting conduction pathway of how this depolarizes, and bang, there it goes. Right? So you see this strange ventricular tachycardia descending very rapidly into fibrillation, this sort of reentrant loop on that activation. So the question is, in a heart like that, we have this strange electrical activation, can we measure any decent mechanics? So we have four cases here. One is normal sinus rhythm. This is a real-time MR data set up here. So we're just using all those, sense and T-sense and everything to go as fast as we can. And we see wall thickening measured in real time. So it's just that's what comes out of the scanner on the screen. You have different types of arrhythmia. This is arrhythmia that generates up above the ventricle, up in the atria, causing sort of normal beats and then boom, boom, a couple of slow beats. So you can see here, basically there's long delays between, so there's a couple of little beats, and then there'll be a very large set of normal beats here. And here, this is a very rare event to capture on MR scanner, is getting the heart into monomorphic ventricular tachycardia. And you can, in an animal model, you can induce this to occur with pacing, if you're lucky. And then this is obviously, a heart that's on its way out. So what does that look like on the SOC? You can see a reentrant excitation pattern on the SOC with a origin, and that origin is the same, it doesn't move in monomorphic VT, and the question is, can we correlate this pattern of electrical reentry with both the geometry of that infarct from those really nice pictures that had the white infarct and the mechanics. And this is just the coil and whatnot that's used for the real-time imaging. But again, this is the real-time images of wall thickening in the dog before we put that sock on. This is after the sock goes on here, so the signal to noise goes down with the sock on. This is a 256 lead sock, which reduces the signal to noise. So this is the arrhythmia that's being generated in the atria, and you can see that you've got these little quick beats and then a big open full-fledged contraction. You can, and this is the painful part. As is always the painful part, is if you're going to quantify this as a function of position, somebody's got to go in and do this, right? And it, so this is still an open problem, in my opinion. It's just like, how do you do this the fastest way, such that you believe the results? And so you can divide the heart into sectors, and so and look at, say, the wall thickening in each sector. And here's, you know, the myocardium gets thicker and thinner and thicker and thinner on each beat, okay, for each sector. And you can look at the, just every sort of row in this MATLAB plot here is one of those sectors. And the red is contraction. And so you can see this arrhythmia, and there is virtually no way that we could, well, I don't want to say that, but it doesn't look likely that you're going to be able to figure out some way of binning data to do retrospective imaging on this stuff. Like finding heartbeats that are the same to do retrospective imaging. And actually it's probably interesting as to, you know, the pattern of these beats and how they change in time. So it's a totally dynamic process. Using really nice images, Hiroshi Ashikaga with Robert Helm, Pat's brother, looked at dogs that had left bundle delay using this method of sector analysis, and I'll show you how they did it in a second, to calculate the delay on the left wall, and they got very reasonable results. So this is not tagging, this is just using sort of traditional wall thickening data. And we'll look at an example here. This is kind of the holy grail would be, if I've got a heart that just bounced into monomorphic VT, so it's basically the excitation pathway is by, for some reason, the infarct is causing the excitation to cycle around on itself, and this heart is, you know, in a very close to lethal load right now. Can we look at the mechanics of this situation? The reason that a signal to noise is low, it's got a sock, it's real time, etc. You can see there isn't much wall thickening up here because that's where the infarct is, but there's some kind of cyclical wall thickening around here, going like this. And when we look at this, here's the infarct image of this slice. So that's the location of the infarct. Here's the, it looks like a clockwise rotation. We have the electrical map showing that activation. And so here is the sectors, you know, of wall thickening for that mechanics. What you can do is look at the Fourier components. So take each one in time, take its Fourier transform, okay? And assume that, you know, these are reproducible beats. They're just coming in and out for this short period of time. And so we have, you know, a peak in the transform here. That's the basic base rate of the heart. And for each sector, if you look at that transform, if you look at the relative phase of that component, you can see it spreads out over about 180 degrees. Okay, so there's a delay of 180 degrees or half cycle around the heart. And so this data here can give you what that time delay is and where the origin of that activation. So, just to summarize, it's obviously very promising in terms of getting detailed mechanical data or real-time mechanical data, which is something that's still in progress, to very detailed morphological data on the substrate of both the mechanics and the electrical activation, and substrate in terms of what the natural progression of that electrical activation would be along the fiber direction. One thing I didn't touch on today, which is something that we're very involved in the lab and have been doing for a number of years, is looking at the immediate response to therapy under MR. Because MR, you can see, when you treat the tissue, you usually can see it. Like here, you've burned some tissue and you can see that burn, you know, within 5 minutes, exactly what's happened. So when you apply any kind of therapy, you can usually see it under MR. So I think with this whole compendium of measurements, perhaps in the next decade or so, we'll be in a good position to kind of come up with a comprehensive model of what's going on in especially arrhythmia and ischemia and old infarcts. Okay, thanks.